2,000 years of world history. We've looked already all the way up to the end of the 1800s. History tells us what has worked and what has not. We need to develop the ability to recognize those lessons in every area of life. The reformer John Calvin said, histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives. And 1 Corinthians 10 verse 6 says, now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. Revelation 11 verse 15 says, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. All nations will come and worship before you. That is the goal of history. We are not like the Eastern religions that have a circular view of history. We've got a linear view of history. At one time, God created the earth. At one time, he gave the Ten Commandments. At one time, Christ came and was born of the Virgin Mary. At one time, he died on the cross and he rose from the dead. And at another point in history, he's coming again. All of history is moving towards this goal. Now, as we come to the end of the 1700s, we move into the 1800s, we are looking at effectively what I summarize as the greatest century of missions. In 1792, English missionary William Carey, a very humble Baptist pastor, writes an inquiry into the obligation of Christians to use means for the conversion of the heathen. Now that is the title of one of the most important missions books ever written, because it galvanized the modern era of missions. And for that reason, William Carey is known as the father of missions, because his humble writings, and when one person tried to denigrate him because he had a very humble background, he barely went past grade 5, very, very inadequate teaching and upbringing. So one lady once said, Mr. Carey, is it true that you were once a cobbler? And he said, that you were a shoemaker? And he said, no ma'am, I was just a cobbler. A cobbler repairs shoes, the shoemaker makes it. She was trying to put him down saying he's a shoemaker, and he said, I wasn't even that good, I only repaired shoes. William Carey was such a humble man, and yet he was one of the greatest masters of languages. And writing this book, which I've read, it's actually quite a very short book, but it's powerful in identifying the problems, showing the biblical principles, and then going right down to giving a list of equipment that every missionary should take. And on the first page, guns, knives, powder, shot. I mean, he was no pacifist. And in 1793, the next year, William Carey sailed for India, never returned to England, and he launched the modern missionary movement. And from that time, it is a fact of history that English-speaking missionaries have made up 85% of the world's missionary task force in 200 years. And they can rant and rave as much as they like about whatever they want, but the fact still is, it's English speakers that have dominated the missions field. This has been overwhelmingly launched by William Carey. And before this time, the English speakers had virtually no involvement in missions. So we praise God for William Carey. And what he did to fight against infanticide and widow burning and all these other social evils. And he translated the Bible into over 26 different languages. Six languages got the whole Bible. The rest got New Testaments or at least Gospels. And Krishnapal, the first convert, being baptized along with his own son, Felix. The Carey Baptist Church is still vibrant in India, and he is one of the true heroes of the faith, a father of modern missions. 1807, the slave trade is abolished by the British Parliament. This iniquitous traffic in human flesh, as William Wilberforce described it, was an open sore on the world, as David Livingston described it. And by God's grace, Christians, evangelicals, mobilized, used every means, including voters' guides, petitions, Christian action groups, and all kinds of interesting techniques in order to bring this before the people and Parliament, and with the biggest petitions the world had ever seen, managed to mobilize as such a force against the very financially lucrative slave trade, which was well entrenched in industry and which owned most of the members of Parliament at the time. When William Wilberforce became a member of Parliament in England, he was one of only two evangelical members of Parliament. By the time he died, there were 100 Bible-believing, born-again evangelical members of Parliament. It's just absolutely extraordinary that in his lifetime, the character of Parliament moved from a self-serving club to a powerful force for philanthropy, and for evangelism and for Christian ethics. And soon they were mobilized in the British Navy and Army to storm the very citadels of the slave traders and set the captives free, intercepting dhows and ships of any nations, even on the high seas, and setting the captives free. And to a large extent, although he didn't work alone, but to a large extent we know that this is because of the work of one very vibrant and dynamic man who never had physical health, but who used what strength he had for the Lord. And the book he wrote, I might add, Practical Christianity, is what David Livingstone said was the most important book he read in his youth, which really obviously influenced so much of what David Livingstone did. And so we praise the Lord that a year and a half ago they produced this excellent film, Amazing Grace, which is available in the library, which is well worth being shown. But most people have forgotten that the slave trade was not just from West Africa to North America. That was only 4.4% of the Atlantic slave trade. Most of the slaves across the Atlantic went into South Central America, into French, Spanish, Portuguese parts of Americas, which doesn't seem to get as much press. But even that is almost insignificant compared to the amount of slave trade that went to the Muslim Middle East and to other parts of Africa. And so that's why our book Slavery, Terrorism, Islam seeks to give the other side of the story. Another major milestone in history, 1812. America's first foreign missionaries, Adoniram and Ann Judson, sail for Burma. This, as America was just moving into a new war with Great Britain, and the sea waves were going to be closed, and the ports were about to be blockaded, and they just slipped out before the blockade could be entrenched on the harbour at Boston, and they sailed for Burma. Tremendous danger, and they couldn't stop at any ports, couldn't stop at Simonstown or anything like that en route because of the danger of being intercepted by the British. And of course, their American ship and their country was at war with Britain. So at that time, 1812, to send out missionaries at that particular moment across the seas, which the British Navy dominated, was a very brave enterprise. And they went to Burma, a Buddhist tyranny, which even today is a Buddhist tyranny. And the treatment they received was absolutely abominable. Adoniram Judson not only was captured in the high seas by the French Navy and escaped from a French prison, but he was captured and tortured for 2 years in death prison, every night having his ankles tied to bamboo and lifted off the ground so that he couldn't lie straight, and he had the most excruciating back pain. He couldn't even walk when his wife saw him. But by God's grace, the British came, America's enemies, and beat the Burmese for their own good reasons and set him free. And so because of the Burmese war, he was able to finish his work, translate the Bible into the Burmese language, which to this day is being used in Burma. In fact, to this day, there are a vast amount of Karen Christians, and you still hear about them because they're involved in one of the longest wars ever. Here there are still an island of Christianity and a sea of Buddhism fighting against the Buddhist military dictatorship. Absolutely extraordinary courage, and that all started from them. In fact, by the time Adoniram Judson died, not only had he put the Bible into Burmese and a grammar and a dictionary, Burmese English dictionary, which is still being used by people to this day in missionaries, but there were 100,000 baptized Korean Christians in Burma. Well, another great date with destiny, not exactly a missionary one, but if it hadn't turned out the way it did, then we would all be speaking French, if we were alive at all. 1815, the Battle of Waterloo, when the English army, the British army under Wellington, and the Prussian army, the German army under Marshal Blücher, united to crush the French of Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo, which was an extremely near-run thing, to quote the Duke of Wellington. It was a very close thing. Napoleon almost won the day, but praise God, the timely arrival of the Prussians and the stalwart defense of especially the Highlanders that held the line, even though they endured massive casualties. Huge casualties at the Battle of Waterloo on the British side, but by God's grace they managed to defeat the French, and if they hadn't, the French revolutionary ideals would have spread further, and the humanism that was behind it and the gospel influences that we got from Germany and from England would not have been as effective. Bear in mind that Holland would have fallen also under the French, and that would have affected a lot of things. 1817, Elizabeth Frey begins ministry to women in prison. Absolutely vital work, and people often forgot just how many people went to prison those days. You could go to prison for almost anything. There were very strict laws at that time. And in Britain, the people who did any crime the second time would be transported off to Australia or any of the places where they could just ditch them out at the furthest end of the planet. Or they got executed. In fact, in the days of Charles Dickens, there were 300 crimes for which you could get executed, which included some things that you and I would consider quite petty. But that's how they got a very law-abiding society, because they had a very harsh criminal justice system. But, of course, at times like that, some people suffer needlessly and too much because there was not enough compassion with the justice, and so the prison ministry is vital. And a lot of Charles Dickens' books were written to speak against the excesses and the unbalances. So her work was absolutely vital. Here at Newgate Prison, teaching prisoners to read, redeeming the time. 1829, Suti, or the burning of widows by the Hindus in India, was outlawed in India as a result of the tireless work of William Carey, who was illegal in India most of that time, because against British law to be a missionary to India for the first 20 years of his ministry. This iniquitous practice of burning alive widows in India brought to an end as a result of involvement of missionaries in social and political issues. At this moment, I'm told, Suti is making a resurgence in India. It's starting to be more popular, and many people think this is our culture, and it's the interfering Christians, and it's the West that stopped this. In fact, do you know that on Pitcairn Island, where the mutineers from the Mutiny on the Bounty went, that Pitcairn Island, which had been a Christian island for many years, that recently the mayor of that island was put on trial for rape, statutory rape, and he argued that the concept of rape is a Christian idea and foreign to the heritage and ancient cultures of their people, and that this idea of having underage is just a Christian idea, which is true. It is. In fact, civilization is Christian anyway. And so he was arguing that according to the ancient culture, he wasn't guilty because this sort of thing would never have been considered crime before the Christians came. Which is true, which proves the point that you can't argue right and wrong on culture. You can only argue right and wrong on the basis of the Bible and the Word of God and the law of God and the existence of God, the Creator and His laws. And if you're going to argue things in terms of culture, then honestly and truly you can justify just about anything. You know, I'm sorry, I don't know the results of that trial. I would hope that I've laughed at him and thrown him in jail. I don't know what else I could have done with him. But just an interesting argument that as people retreat from Christianity, they also retreat from thinking that paedophilia is a crime, or infanticide, or euthanasia, or any other kind of crime. Because it's true, those things were only made crimes because of Christianity. So if you remove Christianity, you'll go back to all the paganism. In fact, we were told, Joel, do you know the source again, that in Japan they are serving babies' fetuses in restaurants as a food dish on the menu in some places? Now, I had heard that some French eating aborted babies. Yes. Cannibalism. And again, this cannibalism is a pre-Christian practice. It's something that Christianity brought into. And so, if you're going to remove Christianity in the post-Christian culture, there's no reason why they wouldn't go back to this thing. And I think that's a very important principle to learn. That's what William Carey proved. Biblical Christianity is what brings about outlawing of all of these evils. Well, we should note, this is the African slave trade. Notice the huge amount of slavery within and where they went to, slavery between Madagascar and Mozambique. The Madagascans used to go and enslave the Mozambicans, the Mozambicans used to go to Malawi and enslave the Malawians, the Malawians went into Zambia and enslaved the Zambians. There's just a huge amount of slave trade. A while ago, when they were talking about that Britain and America must pay restitution to the rest of the world for slavery and so on, the president of Benin, who's a Christian, Bible-believing man, he said, this is ridiculous. Every one of us in Africa is related to both the victims of slavery and the villains of slavery. He said, all of us have got in our bloodlines people who were slave traders and people who were probably involved in slavery. He said, that's just inevitable. So are we all to pay restitution to ourselves and to one another? So this is foolish. Now, I wrote something at the time pointing out that Britain and America are two of the countries that shouldn't be paying restitution because they outlawed it 200 years ago, fought long and hard to end it, and in fact every nation in Europe, barring Portugal, in 1815 signed in the Treaty of Vienna outlawing the slave trade. So Europe is the last place to pay restitution. They already outlawed it, with the exception of Portugal. When I went up to Angola, I found that many of the poor little bushmen were slaves of the Avambos on both sides of the border. And that's why so many bushmen volunteered to join the South African army, because they wanted to get back the tribes that had been causing them so much trouble, to the Avambos, the primary support base of Swapo. Mm-hmm. And there's a massive amount of slave trade. For example, the pygmies in the Congo are treated as slaves. And there's a lot of that, even in Rwanda, discovered how many of the pygmies are treated as slaves in Rwanda and in Burundi. And in Sudan, of course, the slave trade is just endemic, on and on and on and on, with the Arabs. And Darfur has been one of the biggest slave trading states in Africa forever, perpetrators. And so it's interesting that the slave traders who've done the worst atrocities against the people of the Nuba Mountains and Bahr el-Ghazal are now themselves basically reaping what they sowed. So anyway, this whole slave trade needs a lot more study, and that's what the book that we wrote, Slavery, Terrorism, Islam, helps to rectify the imbalance. 1830, Charles Finney's Urban Revivals begin, which had a tremendous influence on America's spiritual climate and attitudes. And Charles Finney had some good points, but the fact is he moved America from the great evangelical awakening, Calvinism, the Reformation, Puritan type faith of Jonathan Edwards and Whitfield, onto a far more emotion-based, sensational, Arminian type of footing, where you could lose your salvation and so on, and where basically man has to cooperate with God, that kind of idea. And while Charles Finney definitely had some good influences, and there's some brilliant quotes from him, the general result of revivalism in America was negative long-term. Short-term looked great, but long-term it eroded the spiritual foundations, whereas you'd have much longer-term good fruits coming from the great evangelical awakening under Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards. The revivalism of Finney's era and what's followed since has been awfully superficial, and the Band of Truth has done an excellent book on revivalism and the death of Christianity, how it has a short sparks and very exciting flash in the pan, but afterwards you've got these burned out areas, as so much of New York State is today, where it's very hard to do any spiritual work, and they attribute some of that to Charles Finney. Now whether that obviously wasn't the intention, but pretty negative end results. Christianity takes a downward left turn. John Nelson Darby then helped start the Plymouth Brethren, which you think is basically a good idea, because the Brethren in many ways are very serious, very sincere Christians, but they again were separatists. Don't change the culture, just separate yourself from the culture and see that you and your family are brought up in the faith, but basically just abdicating. Also, the Brethren were from the beginning, end times, the Lord is coming soon, date setting, sitting on the housetops, waiting for the Lord, and there's a lot of destructive, don't rearrange deck chairs on a ship that's going down, don't hang up wallpaper on a house that's burning, don't waste your time changing the world, the Lord's coming soon, it's all getting burned up and Satan's going to take over, Antichrist, 666, the beast, the seven vials, the seven trumpets. It doesn't really matter about the world, I mean it's all doomed territory anyway. And so the Brethren also, while a lot of the emphasis was good, the long term influence was bad. Just think of how the Brethren in South Africa just a while ago all upped and moved out of the country. Over 10, 11, 12 years ago, they all left and they sold, like the folks across the way from us, that's a Brethren church, and they just sold all their buildings and they left. Australia mostly. It was a decision from the top and they just upped and out of that. That's the Plymouth Brethren. And they are separatists, and so a few of them suffered some bad experience from crime, and so from the top they said God is calling them to shake the dust off their feet and leave this cursed nation behind, because this nation has rejected God and no point being here. Let's go somewhere where we can mind our own business and not be victims of crime. That is a separatist mentality. Good people, sincere people, brethren in Christ without doubt, but the negative effects were bad. So from the revivalism of Finney to the escapism of Darby and the brethren, Christianity is taking some serious left turns. Now, 1839, the Great Trek, of course, we're in South Africa, so this is pretty important to us. It made the map the way that we see it now, as a small group of only about 10,000 Afrikaans trekkers from the Eastern Cape moved in, looking for a new land, thinking of themselves very much in the terms of the book of Exodus, and very much like the promised land people and Israelites going in to take the land of the Canaanites, and they crossed the rivers and they climbed the mountains, and incredibly courageous people, very, very brave, resourceful, tenacious people, trying to escape from the British control of the Cape and trying to make their own land where they could be controlling themselves. Now you can see also how the black nations were moving down, especially the Nguni were moving into KwaZulu-Natal and what today is the Transkei, and so inevitable clash is going to take place. Now, a few interesting things happened, because they would have had a tremendous problem if they tried to do this 5, 6 years earlier or 10 years earlier. But they happened to go in the wake of the devastation of Shaka's Mifikan and Mzilikazi's Mifikan. In fact, Mzilikazi's Mifikan in some ways was far more widespread and caused even more knock-on ripple effect deaths. So that they did move through territory that people had inhabited but were devastated. About 156 tribes were wiped out by the Mifikan. Something in the region of 2.5 to 3 million people would have died in the years of Shaka and Mzilikazi, his general, who fled. Mzilikazi cut a, what they call a path of blood all the way through the Free State and Transvaal as far as Botswana and even up to Kitimulele. So the Great Trek did have some fights on the way, especially with Mzilikazi and with Dingaan. But they mostly moved into territory that was pretty unoccupied because of this Mifikan, or the crushing. Mzilikazi's warriors had just been unstoppable. And before their defeat at Vegkop, they had never been beaten, not even by Dingaan's impis. So a brave group under Saul Saliers and Hendrik Potgieter at Vegkop in the Transvaal gave the Matabele of Mzilikazi the first beating they'd ever had. And you can see where some of the trekkers went. In fact, this is Piet Retief's trek all the way through to Ungundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundundund The Ngunis, well, all the Africans originally came from about Ethiopia. They would have moved down, some moved west. But of course, this is over thousands of years, they would have been moving slowly downwards as pastoralists, those who used cattle and goats and sheep. Whereas the Bushmen had been here long before. And the Bushmen, because they were just hunters, they weren't pastoralists, they did fine until the Hottentots came. The Hottentots were not, they weren't Bantu, they weren't Bushmen, but they were pastoralists as well. And the Hottentots were better armed and they taller and bigger and they beat up the Bushmen. So the Bushmen took it out in their cattle with their poisoned arrows, and so the Hottentots got really furious. And so basically the Hottentots hunted out the Bushmen like animals, and then along came the Nguni tribes and they hunted out the Hottentots and the Bushmen. And so the poor Bushmen got it from every side, and they just had to end up in the desert where no one else wanted to go, and that's where the few thousand that survive today still live. No one's been anywhere, yes. Always. We've all moved.
Yeah.
In fact, look at the migrations. We must look at that some sense. Phenomenal migrations. There's nobody in the place where their original ancestors were. There's been a tremendous movement all over. About the only people who could say that they haven't moved maybe would be the ones in Iraq, because that's where the original Garden of Eden would have been roughly. Funny thought. Well, Shaka Zulu is, of course, one of the most incredible figures in Africa's history, who built this dynamic military machine which was a terror to its neighbours and which presents the worst defeats that both the Boers and the British had ever suffered in their fighting. Piet Retief was a very respected man, one of the best respected men, along with Geert Mertz in the colonies, a very wealthy man. In fact, both Geert Mertz and Geert Mertz and Piet Retief had vast amounts of farms and wealth and good standing in the colonies, that they sacrificed a lot to go on the trek, and of course they shortened their lives dramatically. It all converged on Ungunglovu, the wicked backstabbing brother of Shaka, because Dingaan had stabbed his brother in the back and murdered his own brother. Dingaan was the one who, with no effort on his own part, had inherited this magnificent empire of Shaka, this kingdom of Zulus. And Dingaan was not the warrior that Shaka was. He never went out on fights or anything like that. And the classic problem came when Peter Teeth Gullible's travels left his rifles outside the kraal to go in defenseless before this man who, anyone who'd kill his own brother can't be trusted. Yeah, simple. And to kill the wizards and all of the bloodshed at Blokrans, the murders of so many women and children in the middle of the night by these impis sent by Dingaan created a tremendous amount of distrust and was the worst thing that could have happened. The town of Vienen is built on the sites of many of these. It just means weeping. These are dark days for the trekkers, and many of them would have given up. But this plucky chaplain, Sarol Salier, standing on a cannon with his Bible hand lifted to heaven, made a vow before God and challenged his men to make a vow before the Lord. And this covenant really did put steel in the backbones of these trekkers who otherwise might have given up. And they went out again, and they faced the unbeatable foe, and they beat them, which is an extraordinary thing. And in many ways, this was a victory for the Zulus, because while the Zulus lost 3,000 men in this battle, they gained the gospel. And 3,000 men is nothing compared to how many were killed in a day by Shaka, when his mother died, Nandi, or how many people died at the hands of Dingaan, and how many died even at the hands of Keshwer in a fighting his brother. Tens of thousands killed in a single day's battle to take control of the kingship over his brother who was first in line, and so on. So the Battle of Blood River, while from a human point of view it looks like a great defeat for the Zulus, but spiritually it was the point where the Zulus began to be liberated from the bondage of witchcraft and to have the gospel brought to them. And so in a very real sense, as Mpande came to power, Mpande was crowned, by the way, with Andreas Pretorius's participation. Andreas Pretorius literally crowned Mpande, the half-brother of Dingaan and half-brother of Shaka as well, therefore, and put him on the throne. And there never was another war between the Boers and the Zulus again, which is an extraordinary thing. That one horrible time of conflict under Dingaan, and thereafter missionaries started to have converts amongst Zulus for the first time. The Church of the Vow. The Afrikaans communities are all built around churches. In fact, as you go around many parts of the country, you can still see the tallest structure in the village is the Dutfong church steeple. And everything's built around that, the centre of the town. Not as obvious in the big cities, but in the small towns, very clear. Here you can see all the farmers coming together for the Nachmaal, the celebration of communion once a quarter. And this would be about the only serious fellowship time for many of the families. Most of them probably wouldn't see that many other Boer families, farmers in between. But note the magnificent church built by the trekkers at the very site of the treachery shown against Peter Teeth and his followers, and this magnificent monument, Fort Rica monument in Pretoria, also speaking of how God had really interceded for them. The Anglo-Zulu War, also many of the sites may look like terrible battlefields, but yet through all this, after all this, hundreds of thousands of Zulus came to Christ, until the Zulus are one of the strongest Christian people in the whole continent of Africa. So although they gave the British and the Boers the worst defeats they'd ever suffered and the biggest headaches in Africa, yet the Zulus benefited the most from their defeats at the hands of the Boers and the British, because out of this came magnificent spiritual growth, as Christ's Advance Mission shows us. Now, interestingly enough, at about the same time as the Great Trek has started, just these things have barely ended, David Livingstone comes to Africa. And this is very extraordinary, because David Livingstone comes from the most poverty-stricken background in Scotland. He works like a slave for 10 years, from age 10 to age 20, in a cotton mill, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. And the only day off, they walked miles and miles for hours to get to church and back again. And that was about, that was the only highlight of the week, because the rest of the time was just toiling. And yet he learned to read, and he learned the scriptures, and he memorized Psalm 119, and he won a New Testament at age 9, and he was just reading and learning Greek and learning all sorts of things while he was about his work, just balancing a book, and as he dashed to and fro, he'd catch a sentence here and a phrase there, and he kept his mind busy despite this very unstimulating work. And he comes out to Africa, and in some ways you can think that problems like with hippos crossing rivers in Africa must have been a welcome relief after 10 years of drudgery in the cotton mills in Scotland. And he didn't actually live in much worse poverty living in the mud huts in Africa than he had lived in the terrible tenements in the slums in Scotland. And just to know how God prepared this man and made him such a tough, strong Christian pioneer who was the best friend Africa ever had, to quote some people. And he saw the slave trade, and he expounded and exposed the slave trade and mobilized Britain against it. When Britain thought the slave trade was dead, he was able to let them know it's alive in Central Africa. You might have beaten it in the Atlantic, but it's deadly in the east of Africa and the center of Africa and the Indian Ocean. And by God's grace, his exposing of this through Livingstone's travels and the work of Henry Morton Stanley, the journalist, it really put the death knell to Arab slavery in most of Africa. You see some of the most extraordinary adventures this man had. And how he named Victoria Falls and mapped it, and what he did to liberate the slaves. And about the same time, a contemporary who also met him at the time was Florence Nightingale, sailing for Turkey from a very privileged family. Florence Nightingale disdained the life of ease and parties and all of the things that she could have done. She turned down people who were proposing a marriage. She wasn't interested in that. She wanted something far more interesting. And she said, "Christ has called me to alleviate human suffering." And she starts the modern nursing profession, saves countless lives. Not just the lives she personally saved, but by launching the whole nursing profession and starting this model hospital at St. Thomas's, which is directly opposite from the House of Palace of Westminster, House of Commons, by the Tower Bridge. And in this hospital, she innovated all different techniques which basically saved lots of lives. Big windows, fresh air, clean, hygienic, all sorts of things, professional code. Nurses have been the lowest form of society looked down, and she made it a profession that people from noble backgrounds could be proud to be part of. She lifted the whole status of nursing and saved many, many lives as a result, including in India. She saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of Indians, probably millions, by all that she did to intervene with the British government to improve the health and the sanitation in India, massive saving of life in the British Army in particular. Well, Hudson Taylor arrives in China in 1854, another great date with destiny, how God used this young man who was so ashamed, for example, of the fact that he was so light-skinned, he wanted to be Chinese, that he just about killed himself with peroxide trying to dye his hair black. His blonde hair black, and the whole thing somehow exploded. He got it wrong, and I mean, he had glass all over his face, and he could have been blinded for life with a very poor technique of trying to get rid of his blonde Anglo-Saxon looks. And he wanted to be like the Chinese, and he innovated wearing Chinese clothes. And what he did in China is absolutely amazing. He launched the first interdenominational faith mission. He launched the first mission that took lay people. Didn't require Bible college training to come to the mission. He's the first one to allow women to join in missions. First one to have interdenominational missions. The first one to have a mission that had no fundraising, faith mission. So, and he stopped the old way of missionaries up to then was to go to the coastal areas, which of course had best support. He said, no, we've got to go into the interland. So it's called the China Inland Mission. He went at the worst time. China involved in a terrible civil war. Millions killed. Massive amounts of violence there. He saw how many people beheaded and hung and shot, and yet the man persevered, and what he did in China was absolutely extraordinary. By the time he died, China in the Mission was the largest mission society in the world. Well over 1,000 missionaries in the field in China. An extraordinary achievement. We've looked quite a lot at Charles Spurgeon at previous meeting. Charles Haddon Spurgeon became pastor in London in 1854, and this boy preacher became the marvel of his age. The Puritan prince of preachers preached to more people than anyone else had ever, and also became not only the greatest preacher of an age of great preachers, but to this day he remains the most prolific author in Christian history. No other Christian, living or dead, has produced more books, more pages, more words, something like 20 million words of published print, just, and his books have never been out of circulation. 100 million copies of his sermons have been sold by 1917. They've surely run lost count since then. He really was one of the great preachers of an age of great preachers. And so he does deserve a lot of attention. When Charles Spurgeon took a text, he took it seriously, and he used it to point people to Christ. One of the last of the Puritans. But another contemporary, a very different man, although he began his work also amongst children and also developed a college, but Dwight L. Moody's conversion had a very different effect, because while Spurgeon was a pastor at one point, Metropolitan Tabernacle, Dwight L. Moody was an itinerant evangelist. And while Spurgeon was a Calvinist, Moody was an Arminian. But Moody greatly respected Spurgeon, and in many ways probably followed many of his techniques and styles. 1857, David Livingstone publishes his Missionary Travels, one of the greatest missionary books of all time, which mobilized vast amounts of missionaries into the field. So the publication of Missionary Travels by David Livingstone was really a landmark in church history. And as he said, as he walked across Africa, mind you, at the end of his life, he gave this great challenge. These are some of the places explored. At the end of his life, David Livingstone said, "I beg to direct your attention to Africa. I know that in a few years I shall be cut off in that country, which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. It is for you to carry out the work which I have begun. I'll leave it with you." Unfortunately, 1861, tragic event of the United States and the Confederate States fighting, the war between the states. And you might be interested to know that David Livingstone's oldest son, Robert, died in the war between the states. And he's buried in Arlington Cemetery. Something that he did, no doubt, in slight rebellion against his father to get involved, but also it showed a desire on his part to do something noble and brave and to make a stand. Well, I think it's quite sad that he's involved in that particular conflict and on the northern side too. But all the same, a lot of courage. There's a tremendous revival in the camps, by the way. I was just reading about that recently with homeschooling, how D.L. Moody was preaching amongst the troops, and there was real revivals. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers came to Christ on both sides. There were revivals, especially in the southern camps, but amazing amounts of growth in the gospel at that time. And many of the churches were very cold before, but the war between the states, tragic though it was, did lead to a vast deepening of people's relationships with the Lord. Unfortunately, it also led to the United States becoming more of a centralized country instead of, before that, they used to speak about the United States of America are. Afterwards, it became the United States of America is. And the sovereign states became basically just part of a federal whole, which was not the same. The Confederate states actually were more true to the founders, Jefferson and Adams and George Washington, in saying that each state is equal and each state was independent, and that the federal government had very limited powers. But unfortunately, it went from these United States of America are to the United States of America is. Thinking. America would have been better off going the Swiss Confederation route, where each state is autonomous and makes their own laws, than this federal system where the top-down pushes everyone below them. And for example, you know what Roe v. Wade was? It was the federal government saying that the local governments couldn't prohibit abortion. That's what Roe v. Wade was in 1973. The federal government interfered in all these matters, and that's wrong. At any rate, the war between the states, monumental courage, but terrible consequences. But 1865, William Booth founds the Salvation Army to deal with the darkest England, as he said, to deal with the pagans in London. And a magnificent work of William Booth. The Salvation Army has been one of the greatest forces for lifting up people in the gutter and caring for some of the most down and out people and dealing with the drunkards and the people involved in gambling and in addictions and rescuing people from lives of absolute misery in the gutter. So Salvation Army has done a magnificent work. 1870, Pope Pius IX proclaims a doctrine of papal infallibility. Of course, they'd acted like it for centuries, but now they've promulgated it as a doctrine. And once it was a doctrine, it means that any Christian who doesn't believe in this is damned to hell, anathema, and all the rest of it, and no chance of salvation. It's now a dogma. You must believe it or you can't be saved, according to the Pope. Not that that particularly bothers any Protestant, but anyway. And so, here they've got the damp Roman candle. They're trying to light this anathema on anyone who doesn't believe in this. 1886, the student volunteer movement begins, one of the greatest missionary movements, where they go into universities to recruit students for missions. And that led to a great outpouring at the end of the century. Okay, the great figures of this century, of the 19th century, William Carey, the father of modern missions, William Wilberforce, God's missionary to Parliament, Adoniram Judson, the first American foreign missionary, David Livingston, the Scotsman who walked across the continent and was the first proclaimer of the gospel of Christ in many regions in Africa. Charles Spurgeon, the Puritan prince of preachers. D.L. Moody, the shoe salesman who became a most dynamic Sunday school teacher, who became one of the most dynamic evangelists America has ever produced. Florence Nightingale, who founded the nursing profession. Hudson Taylor, the great missionary who launched the China Inland Mission, the first interdenominational faith mission. William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army. And that brings us to the greatest century of persecution. And we won't get far into that, but let me just start off a little bit of it, because we'll deal with most of this next week. But the greatest century of persecution began with the Anglo-Boer War in South Africa. 1899 to 1902, this 20th century begins with a big empire, the world's greatest empire that has ever been seen up to that stage in terms of size and extent, bullying the Boer republics of Transvaal and the Free State. And it was all over diamonds and gold when you get down to it. The Free State had first diamonds at Kimberley, and you can see Kimberley's between the Orange and the Vaal River, and by the Sand River Convention, Kimberley's part of the Free State. But when they discovered diamonds there, the British made themselves arbitrators and then somehow took it away from... You just look at the map, you can see this interesting curve. And just some of the British took Kimberley back. Well, the Free State thought they'd been cheated. They had. But they could praise God, it gave them a bit more peace, because otherwise they would have had a war right back then in 1869, which they wouldn't have been ready to fight anyway. Alfred Milner was the very iniquitous individual who was the architect of this war. The road that runs past here is named after him. Not a worthy name. In fact, as we were speaking to some of our friends at Parliament about all the name changes that they're trying to make around South Africa, and they're trying to rename streets that are named after people very precious to our heritage. And it's been pointed out that if they want to change names, why don't they build their own roads in their own towns and name them? But if they do have to change some, we have got something like 17 Victoria roads and avenues in Cape Town alone. We've got how many roads named after Milner throughout this country? We've got also, you could trim them down a bit. You don't, if they need to rename some, there's a bunch of people like Cecil Rhodes and Milner that nobody's going to particularly be upset if you change that name. But there's an attitude in the side of the Marxists that they want to often get rid of some great Christian leaders and then put in some Marxist revolutionary terrorist's name there, which isn't exactly what any of us are after. But anyway, I wouldn't mind if somebody renamed Milner Road. And the man who was standing in the way of Milner's goal of taking the gold-rich Transvaal and turning it into a British colony was Paul Kruger, who was one of the original fur trickers. He was actually, as a young boy of, was he 10 or 11, in the Battle of Vechtkop, one of the men at age 11 fighting against the Matabele in the Battle of Fekpo. And President Steyn, who was one of the most outstanding Christian politicians ever. I mean, just take what a humble man he was. When President Steyn declared war on Britain, he stepped down from being president, handed over to the commandant general, which was Christian de Wet, and enlisted in the army as a simple soldier and the commander, and he fought the whole time under the instruction of his general in his top hat and tails, because he said, well, when a politician declares war, he proves that politics has failed, and then we can't declare war without taking the consequence ourselves, and we can't send other men off to war without going ourselves. So he, as a gentleman, became one of the bitter enders. He fought to the end. And he was one of the last ones to come and make peace at the Peace of Vereeniging. So President Steyn really stands as an absolutely outstanding Christian. Imagine if we had presidents in the world like that today. But no, they declare war, they don't go, and then they still want to interfere and tell the generals what to do, which isn't the way Steyn did it. Well, the British thought this would be easy. Bunch of farmers. You know, here we are, professional army. It's going to be so easy beating these farmers. But they forgot all these farmers could ride, all of them could shoot, they knew the land, and they had a whole lot of other advantages. They didn't wear red uniforms, they didn't stand in the open, and they had a support system all the way throughout with their families and the different farmers. And here you have three generations, a grandfather, a father, and son. So you've got three generations standing here together going out to fight. This wasn't just a few conscripts. There are documented cases of boys as young as 11 years old going off into battle in the Anglo-Boer War. There's even some cases of some women who went off to fight as well. So, not many, but there were cases. Some of the weapons that they used in this, first war, where both sides were using magazine-fed breech loaders. No longer single shots. It's not just cartridges, breech loading. And they even had automatic pistols like the Mauser. A few people like Winston Churchill had that. That was the latest in technology. But when the British went in that Black Week, they got absolutely creamed. They had no idea how many men the Boers could drop in 1 minute with breech-loading Mauser rifles. At 1 mile, the Boers were accurate. They bought them from Germany, Mausers, but remember, of course, they had money from the gold mines and the taxes they put on the British Uitlanders that enabled them to buy Krupp cannons and Mauser rifles. Just another reason why in the in the First World War, the Boer general in charge of the Union Defence Force, General Beyers, resigned. He said, I can't fight for our old enemies, the British, against our old friends, the Germans. And he resigned. That's the Chief Defence Force. And General Christian de Wet was put in jail for refusing to fight. And General de la Rey, one of the greatest war heroes the Boers had, was shot by police at a roadblock by accident, they said. They thought he was a bank robber. Well, one of the first things they did was... Sorry? Exactly. Yeah, now, I mean, politicians lie. Even when they die, they lie still. And this is one of the railways in Natal where Winston Churchill's armoured train was ambushed. That was a whole interesting story in and of itself, where he was actually captured by President Louis Botha, a person who later became Prime Minister Louis Botha, I should say. And how interesting it would have been if Winston Churchill hadn't forgotten his Mauser pistol in the train, because if he came around the corner with that in his hand, General Botha would certainly have taken him out as a very experienced man. And where would Western history have gone without? I mean, there's no way that Churchill would have gotten the better of Botha. Botha was a very accomplished soldier and a marksman. So the fact that he forgot his pistol at that moment was a very good thing for Churchill. And things may have been very different otherwise. Well, there were all sorts of battles where the British thought they could march across open fields and they could not believe the casualties they suffered at the hands of the Boers. And the British, who have a reputation for fighting fair and clean, can become very nasty and mean when they start losing. And so when they started to suffer such chronic defeats at the hands of this despised enemy, they started to get extremely mean. And that's when the concentration camps began, that's when the burning of the farms began, and that's where they started to poisoned wells, and this is the relief of Ladysmith, for example. There's an enormous amount of courage on both sides, and there was a lot of, as Sir Conan Doyle, the author of the whole Elementary, my dear Watson, the Sherlock Holmes stories. Conan Doyle said the Anglo-Boer War provided no end of lessons for the British Army. In fact, without that, the British Army would not have been ready for the First World War. And even then, they got creamed multiple times, as it is, because they were really not very well led. But it improved their equipment, it improved their tactics, improved all sorts of things, because they were really taught a lesson over and over. This is the relief of Kimberley. Kimberley didn't look too good by the time they relieved it. And the British started to fight very, very unfairly. They would take Boers and shoot them for being spies, because they weren't wearing uniforms. But no, Boers had uniforms. You know, things like this. They're all sorts of ridiculous things. You know, you're not wearing a military uniform. Well, we don't have military uniforms. Well, you're not regular soldiers, therefore you're spies. And they burned farms. They poisoned wells. They dynamited wells. They round up the women and children, put them in concentration camps. It was extremely vicious. And this Lord Kitchener played a dirty role. A shameful, shameful role. By the way, you know Lord Kitchener, who instituted this whole scorched earth concentration camp policy, he got sunk by a submarine in the First World War. Just desserts. Not a good man. And Milner didn't do very well either. Milner, in fact, Africa got their revenge. He came back to Africa after being drummed out in 1906. And when Botha got the upper hand, but when he came back to Africa for a visit, I think in 1912 he died of malaria, so Africa definitely got him anyway. But here you've got a place like Colesberg, very bad areas, and these women and children living in the most terrible conditions. But by God's grace, Emily Hobhouse, a courageous Englishwoman, did make the atrocities known and did a lot to galvanize the people of England with photographs like these of the tragedies and the deaths of young children in these incredibly unhygienic, abominable conditions that they were dying under. And these are some of the pictures that Emily Hobhouse made known in England. And these were the concentration camp deaths, details that they put in the newspapers, published it, and let people know just how many people were being killed and how many children were being killed. And the totals per month, thousands were dying in the concentration camps, and if it wasn't for people like Emily Hobhouse, it would have been a lot more deaths, a lot more. The thing that's so important about this, if it hadn't been for the Anglo-Boer War, and if it hadn't been for the death toll, particularly in the camps of the women and children at the critical stage, remember at that stage, the average woman was having 12 babies. So, if it hadn't been for that at this critical time, we would, by 1980, and I don't know what the stats would be extrapolated now, but by 1980, South Africa would have had 11 million Afrikaners. That's the extrapolation from that time. Just such a critical time that you wouldn't have had so many of the different things that happened as a result of, for example, at the end of the Second World War, Australia was receiving millions of people from Europe who'd had their homes destroyed, who maybe had fled from behind the Iron Curtain, and Europe held nothing for them. I mean, my mother left Europe at the end of the Second World War, and to her, it's held nothing but bad memories. Bombings and lootings and all the terrible things that she had seen. So, she never went back. To her, Europe just was the two world wars in one century. Who wants to go back there again? And both my parents moved from Europe to Africa for, I'm sure, very good reasons. To them, Africa was a place of peace, Europe was a place of war. And yet South Africa, because South Africa had at that moment gotten rid of Smuts, just like Britain got rid of Churchill immediately after the war, just like America gets rid of Bush immediately after they've had their victories in Afghanistan and so on. You know, just interesting thing, countries aren't always loyal to their own leaders who lead them in times of war. But at that time, with Smuts out, National Party in, D.F. Milan didn't want any white immigrants in South Africa, because white immigrants could upset the balance of power of the National Party. And so they stopped white immigrants coming into South Africa. South Africa could have got millions more from Europe, but because they felt so vulnerable, there weren't enough Afrikaners, because of the Anglo-Boer War, because they saw They were happy to bring millions of black people in as migrant labourers, but they didn't want any whites in the country because they would be a threat to their electoral system. My mother had stamped on her ID book, and I saw it, enemy alien. Yeah, honestly, in the ID book, enemy alien, for goodness sakes, how many years after the war? And that's the kind of mentality that there was right then. South Africa could have got millions of immigrants, just like America and Australia did, but we chased them away at that key time. So you can look at so many different reasons why we imbalanced and why the demographies worked out how it is and why there's just such a lot of politics of race and numbers and all of that. It didn't have to be like that. We could have had all sides feeling comfortable and in balance, but the imbalance caused by this genocide of Boer women and children at that critical time created horrible ripple effects, right down to the fact that I felt it when I was in the army, being the only Engelssprekende Roynik in my whole peloton, and there was still this great hostility, and I said, hey, I mean, I wasn't involved in that ball. I'm on your guy's side. I mean, gee, I think the British were totally wrong on Anglo-Boer War side. Gee. There was this, you know, yeah, but the Rhodesians fought on the side of the British and Anglo-Boer War. Yes, but they were wrong. I don't defend that. I'm not taking that side. It might have been my people, but honestly and truly, I'm on the Afrikaans side when it comes to the Anglo-Boer War. But still, there was a lot of hostility. I mean, how many decades later, the anger of the people, they didn't trust the English, and who can blame them? The English really treat them badly. Christian de Wet was a really Christian general, one of the greatest of the generals. What a great man, and boy, did he run circles around the English, and he did just the most amazing things. And Christian de Wet, his statue is just outside Town Hall in Bloemfontein. A bold, brave man who always fought in top hat and in a Sunday outfit. General Louis Botha, a very courageous man as a guerrilla fighting in Natal and as the first Prime Minister of South Africa. I might add, do you know what his very first act was as Prime Minister of South Africa? To release King Dinis Zulu of the Zulus from wherever he was locked up at that stage. I forget if it was Robben Island or St. Helena, but the British had him locked up for the Bambata Rebellion. He didn't spend long in there, because the moment that Louis Botha got in there, because Louis Botha was an Italian, and he was a near neighbor of Dinis Zulu, he knew the Zulus, he spoke Zulu, and he made sure his very first act was, and Dinis Zulu was not welcomed back because of the way of the clan fighting, infighting there. So Dinis Zulu spent his last years on Botha's farm and died there. And just interesting that he remembered his childhood friendships and his relationship with the Zulus. And again, just showing how the Boers and the Zulus never fought one other game after the Battle of Blood River. They were always friends and allies and neighbours. And I'm glad that we had a man of the stature of Prime Minister Botha. Although, I'm sorry that he got himself suckered into fighting on Britain's side in the First World War. I think we should have set that out. I don't think it was our war. Anyway, you can see the British Natal and Cape Colony, the Boer Free State in Transvaal, where the battles were. The British, of course, controlled southern Rhodesian Bechuana land, so unfortunately they were on the British side. And I've read articles, even recently, from Rhodesia saying, we really fought on the wrong side in the Anglo-Boer War. Considering how treacherously Britain dealt with us, we should not have fought our Boer neighbours in the Anglo-Boer War. And I think that's a correct assessment. And Ian Smith certainly agrees with that too. 1903, something that's going to have a huge impact on the rest of civilization. Vladimir Lenin organizes the Bolshevik Revolutionary Group, out of which the Communist Party of the Soviet Union developed. And small things start in upper rooms. Speaking of which, 1906, the Azure Street Revival launches Pentecostalism in this upper room. Apostolic Faith Gospel Mission. So you got the Communist Party launched 1903, you got the Pentecostal movement launched 1906. And boy, have they spread like wildfire. From opposite sides, of course. But the Azure Street Revival launched Pentecostalism, which are the fastest growing churches in Christianity. Notice the Los Angeles Daily Times article announcing the event. Weird babble of tongues. New sect of fanatics is breaking loose. Wild scene last night in Azure Street. Gurgle of wordless talks by a sister. So, they could not have known where this was going to go. 1910, publication of the Fundamentals launches the Fundamentalist movement, which in some ways was good because they were saying virgin birth, the sinless life, the atoning death of Christ, bodily resurrection, the return of Christ. They were standing for certain fundamentals. You would think that's good, but the problem with the Fundamentalists is, again, they were like separatists. They were just, let's just draw the logger and protect these few things. They weren't thinking in terms of the big picture. Instead of saying the whole Bible applies to all of life, which is where we stand, they were saying we won't retreat beyond this. They drew a line in the sand, they pulled their wagons around in a logger, and they said this is what you'll fight for. But basically they gave the rest of society over to the humanists. It's not the right way to go. That's as far as we're going to go tonight. I guess the next step is into the First World War and all the things that happened, and that is a whole other story. Any questions at all? Correct. Throughout the whole British Empire, because the slave trade, 1834, the slave trade was abolished in 1807, but slavery wasn't abolished. The slave trade, no new slaves. Now, at that point, William Wilberforce was still fairly young, but he fought all the way the rest of his life until the slavery itself was abolished and every slave was set free, and that was on his deathbed in 1833. But they had to give him a year to train their slaves, to give them new jobs and prepare them, and to give compensation. And they didn't just want the people to go out. They wanted to be sure they were provided with skills, with clothing, with income, with land. So it was a very well thought out plan that the evangelicals had put together before the British Parliament. And so that's why, from the 1st of December, 1834, that's when every slave had to be set free in the British Empire. Most of which were, of course, in Jamaica. But there were very few in Cape Town, and none of the slaves in southern Africa were from Africa. In fact, they came from mostly Malaya. In fact, you know that the Dutch treated the Cape like the British treat Australia. They sent the criminals to the Cape. So a lot of good things happened in the 19th century, but I'm afraid the 20th century is a whole different story. This is when things go wrong from the first year. I mean, the Anglo-Boer War was setting a horrible tone, which I'm afraid, after such brilliant Christian advances in the 19th century, the 20th century becomes a century of real barbarism and evil, and it just gets worse and worse. That's why, of course, where we're going is the challenge of where's the 21st century going to go, and of course that's very much up to the church. Are we going to wake up and use what we've got, or are we going to let things continue to deteriorate? So the world's coming to a very serious crisis at this moment. Well, we're in it. We've been in most of our lives, but the 20th century, in my mind, has been the most evil century of all. It's been reversing centuries of gain of Christianity, and that's of course where I want to go next week, and where we are now. The Cape of Good Hope, first of all, when the Portuguese explorer Bartholomew Dias came around, he called it the Cape of Storms, which makes sense. This is where the cold Atlantic and the warm Indian meet, and we have some spectacular storms here. And we've got, what, 187 different shipwrecks around the Cape Peninsula? Something like that, I've read. In the tourist books, 187 shipwrecks. I mean, some spectacular shipwrecks around the Cape. Some mega ships have got shattered on our rocks. But the Portuguese king, Henry the Navigator, said, no, this has been too negative. Let's call it the Cape of Good Hope. So the Portuguese actually called Cape of Good Hope first. They said, it's giving us hope that we can find a new route across to the Indies. And so it was hope for the Indies. Now, the Dutch took it over because they thought this is better for tourism and better for people to move out here and settle to supply the sailors came across. But the Portuguese king, Henry the Navigator, who first gave it that name of Good Hope. How many times have papers changed hands? If you go to the castle and see all these different flags, for good reason. I noticed they don't have the French flag over there. Well, accurately speaking, they should. But we've changed hands a few times to Cape. This was one of the most important strategic naval outposts in the world. It was a very critical one for the sea routes. And it's been amazing how many times the Cape has changed hands, and yet the people here are awfully pacifist and very liberal in their thinking in Cape Town. if we go back to the Reformation, we get our better roots, yeah, which is appealing to the better side of things. We can all come up with things in our past where our ancestors have done terrible things to one another, but how constructive is that? It's far more constructive to look at the revivals and the reformations and the great Christian actions and see that, well, God's grace can supersede all of our own sinfulness and foolishness. And this is the other thing we want to learn from the history, that we can do better in the future, that we don't stay stuck in the old ruts of some very negative things. And this is, to me, one of the main theses when we look at all of this history, that a lot of the enemies that we have come up with and thought, well, these are historic enemies, have not been historic enemies. You know, for example, the hostility between the Afrikaans and the English hasn't always been that way, as you've said, in Reformation times and fighting the Spanish. And also the hostility between the Germans and English historically has not been so. Battle of Waterloo, it was the Germans who saved the English army. They were about to get flattened by Napoleon. If the Prussians hadn't turned up in the nick of time, at great sacrifice, and they came a spectacular distance, very fast. And the British don't always give the credit that they should, but they were about to get wiped out. If Blücher hadn't arrived with the Prussians, Napoleon would have won the day. Of course, Blücher wouldn't have won the day if the English hadn't held the line long enough to keep Napoleon there until he could get to them. So it was a team effort, but neither would have won it on their own. And the Germans and the English have been historically great friends, and bear in mind that both Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were totally German. And the German origins of England is seen in the Saxons, Saxons Germans, Wessex, West Saxons, Essex, East Saxons, Sussex, South Saxons. The English and the Germans are one people, and they've always been historically allies. How they came to be enemies in the First World War is absolutely extraordinary. How Britain came on the side of France, their traditional enemy going back who knows how many centuries, is just phenomenal that could have happened. And in fact, there's a few anecdotes as to how the reprobate son of Queen Victoria, King Edward, was really very much liking the French, and how he changed British traditional policy basically over a drinking bout in Paris. And it's inexplicable how Britain changed its policy except over this really bad Edward. Queen Victoria would never have gone to war with her birthplace and the whole relationship they had there. And again, how Protestants came to be enemies and allies of Catholics. I mean, traditionally, Germany and Austria have been enemies, because Germany is Protestant, Austria is Catholic. Traditionally, Britain and France have been enemies, because France is Catholic and Britain is Protestant. Suddenly, in the First World War, we've got Protestants and Catholics on both sides fighting Protestant Catholics. Extremely weird. And suddenly, Britain's on the side of Russia, which had been the enemy in the Crimean War and how many other times. So there's a lot of things that you have to go behind the scenes, which we want to do next week, and look at just the things that manipulated and changed the allegiances of people. And to me, I just see it as anti-evangelical, anti-Christian, anti-missions, because what you did was you had the greatest missionary-sending nations on earth fighting one another and depleting one another and wiping out millions of one another. The First World War was far worse than the Second in terms of sheer body count of the soldiers and the destruction. Yes, in 1914, Christian nations ruled just about the whole world except for the Ottoman Empire. But by the end of the Second World War, the pagans were taking over just about everything. And suddenly you had these great Christian nations like Britain and Germany moving to 4-6% church attendance. It's absolutely, you could see the whole purpose of these wars, as far as I can understand, was to kill the missionary hearts and the missionary sending nations of the world, and to basically put Christianity on a retreat. And who filled the vacuum? Communism, humanism, Islam. In a word, paganism. And so how the world moved from a Christian century of the 19th century to a pagan century in the 20th century, that's the story we want to look at next week. But of course, we don't stop there. We don't want to look at how we're going to make 21st century a Christian century again. Because we only look at history to make a better future. We're not stuck in the past. We want to learn from the past to implement the lessons in the future.